Okay. Alan, should we introduce ourselves?
Sure.
This is Alan Lundell.
Hi.
This is Bruce Dammer. And we co-founded the
DigiBarn Computer Museum. We're going to learn a little bit about how that was done today. If you're a budding collector, you may, after seeing this, not want to do it. Can everybody see the screen, or where should I sort of stand? Am I fine? Sorry about the screen quality. They gave us probably the worst projector in the house, which I don't understand. But this is going to be the saga of the DigiBarn Computer Museum, which is in its 10th year and the 20th year collecting, from my perspective. So we'll get going. And as you can't read these, it's fine. It'll all become clear later. But we're going to take you through the beginnings, the construction of rooms, the virtual tour of the collections. How do you handle it when celebrities show up? You're all very nervous because celebrities have shown up. The media, how to handle all the camera crews and whatever. If they show up at your collection, what do you do? And then we'll show you some the mascots, the pigs will be featured. And the annual birthday party is one of which is tomorrow. So the beginning, in the beginning, Nerd Buys Farm now owns 5,000 square foot barn, which used to be used for cider press. And there's the barn there from a helicopter. What do you do with it? The big one.
Before everything was done.
And do you want me to sit down?
Alan.
Oh, Alan.
All right, I'll stand behind the camera.
He'll make quips from behind the camera. That's dangerous. So here's the barn in 98. It was kind of rough hewn. It was built about 1910 out of old growth redwoods. It's up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So one day, you know, this barn is there, and Nerd doesn't know what to do with it. And Al and I go to... Alan?
A weird stuff warehouse, not too far from here. What you got today is in Lincoln, your crazier mods.
And at Weird Stuff, Alan spots a computer that only costs...
I don't know, I think it was a dollar for that one,
right? A dollar.
Yeah, I used to have the one on the left. It was just exciting. Just quite
Televideo 910, I used to program on one of those myself. So immediately overcome with emotion, overcome with just kind of, you know, affection. It's like you're a little gosling you imprinted on a machine, right? When you were the gosling, and you'll never forget it. Just like how the geese imprinted on the hang glider. Remember that? It happens. There's the $1 Macintosh LC. And there's Alan. So here we are, we're arriving back. And Alan is doing the heavy lugging, which he does to this day. And so everybody arrives back, and voila, a museum is born. And we say, now what have we done? Well, see, on the lower right, you can see a Apple II. That's actually Alan's Apple II.
Oh, one other thing. This room, Bruce's wife had visions of a music studio.
Oh, dear. It will be built. So what did we do? Alan had brought his old computer. We had sort of wiped off the rat shit off the top of it, and then found these floppies. And Alan says,
"Check this out. This was an original floppy invitation to the US Festival given to me by Laws when I was an Inform World journalist. And it was a really that innovation. It had graphics, animation, sound, the whole thing. 1981.
And so even had." Was. So basically, in one fell swoop, we had all these machines sitting on the ground. We had an Apple II running, a real cool artifact. And you'll see this artifact appears later. So the DigiBarn was born. But I'd been collecting since 87. That was my first machine. Going past a yard sale in Los Angeles, and there was this thing on the table that was brass, and it was all beautiful and everything, and it said patented July 19th, 87. And I thought, this isn't 1987, it's 1887. And I have to have it. It was $15, and it's a felt and tarrant comptometer.
What?
A comptometer.
Oh, okay.
Hand crank adder multiplier.
Yeah.
They made, you know, millions of them.
1887.
So it was a 100-year-old personal computing device. So what have we done? Well, we've got to get building. We realize that we've got to actually rebuild a whole bunch of rooms. So here's a, believe it or not, these two people are getting married at the farm, and for the work trade, they had to do this horrible project. So they're bashing the walls out. There's the sledgehammer coming through and putting up all this insulation. This is definitely a couple in love, because the farm used to be used by the prior family for weddings for their family. And so they need a wedding spot. They had to work for it. So there they are. There's the groom there on the right. And the bride is on the left.
The orbs.
The orbs. And there we are putting the Ethernet cable, the Cat5 cable there to wire it from the house. And more effort getting this thing open. So here's the diagram from, I figured, okay, barn and computer museum, how do they fit together? How do you make tours? What is the tour? You're basically taking people along the ground floor, which is nice paved, you know, bottom floor, because it was a cider press farm. Entrance into, and we decided that the first room would be the major lineages, the sort of the bang for the buck from the homebrew revolution, all the machines. You ever have a timeline? Now this place is building a timeline too. And then we realized, well, we have these three hay lofts, which have been converted into rooms, so we'll take people up the stairs and through some other collection and then down the stairs, and we've just gotten a Cray supercomputer, which we'll show you more about. And they would kind of end up there and then come out. So there's the upstairs rooms. So we sort of, and this model has stayed to this day. This is, when you come on the tour, this is the same thing, really, embellished by the addition of many artifacts by people who visit. They drop the artifacts in the right places. And, of course, we needed a mascot. And what better mascot than the pigs, which live in the horse stalls outside the barn. So the pigs became the mascot. We had this brainstorming session. And then I said, oh, God, we need a logo. And I'm a cartoonist, so I sort of thought, one day I was super spaced out, more than usual, and had this vision of a Commodore pet with a barn door on the side of it. So this is what you're getting. You get the Commodore pet with 2002 instead of 2001, you know, the pet series 2001 is the thing. But since this opened to the public in 2002, we called it the 2002 series. And there's the pig behind and the barn door. So that's been the logo ever since. Yet to be on t-shirts and hats, but we might start that. And then the volunteers showed up. I don't know where they came from, but suddenly, they're like flies to shit, they're here. So, no, it's truly, it was a wonderful community of people who volunteered for several weeks, redoing the power, putting in new lighting, everything you imagine, bringing their own systems, putting in networking for things, restoring machines, because the opening was coming up, and it's July 13th. And there's the cleaning crew. There's Gail in there with Jake Bowman. And machines were pouring in the spring of 2002. This is a complete Xerox 6085 network that arrived in one sudden Sunday morning. And this is the Cray 1 arriving. There it is being loaded over at NASA Ames. Tony Cole here. Tony Cole's in the other room. This came via Tony Cole. And there they are unloading it and putting it in sort of an epic. And here we are, finally last year, tying the transformers to the processor tower so that if there's an earthquake, the processor tower won't come over. And we had to line up the bolt plates. It was a mammoth job because the transformers are full. They're complete. They're 800 pounds apiece. They're full of oil. But one night, I sat bolt upright saying, I wonder if the coolant in there is PCBs. Because if it is, we're a Superfund site. And I called my friend who knew everything about Crays, and he called Cray Research and Chippewa Falls, and they said, just oil, don't panic, you know, don't sweat it. I said, could have got all those government grants. So here's the Macintosh crew putting together the Macintosh network for the opening, Macintosh TV, the signage crew. Everything is sort of whimsical and fun and funny, and there's Alan.
Yeah, this is after setting this stuff up for 2 days straight. We just had to relax and enjoy with you.
And here's Galen, the marshaling of the troops. And this is at the morning, this is early in the morning of the opening day. This is our volunteer crew, many of whom are actually here, who work as docents here. We are open. So now the collections. So this is a virtual tour. Sorry, it's a bit fuzzy. We'll take you on a virtual tour because we're not going to lead a tour this year because there's just too much to do on Sunday. I just can't break away from our link group to go out and take you guys on a tour. But we'll go. Here's the back of the door of the barn. And as you come in, it's a barn. You can't mistake it for a shiny museum. It definitely feels like a garage. In fact, the Digibarn is sort of like the largest garage in Silicon Valley in a lot of ways, because the garages of Silicon Valley and elsewhere are emptied out into this place.
The garages of Silicon Valley were like the barn of the Silicon Mountains.
Garages of St. Louis, too. And so here's a huge PDA collection that came, complete with a Curta, and there's several more comptometers and some of the flight computers and the knitting computers. And we're starting to sort of branch out. The whole thing started with my passion about telling the Xerox story, which I felt was tremendously underrepresented, and the birth of the graphical interface. But it spread into any interface, including mechanical interfaces. So there's more calculators. About 150 calculators came in last Christmas. And then here we are in the lineage room. There's our Altair 8800, all signed by the homebrew club members that were at our homebrew event. And so you can see that the tables, it goes along the tables, and there's stuff that's been actually put there by people who came. So they've been adding to the exhibit as it goes along. And everything that's here goes on the website and is also massively cross-linked. So here we are. This is the poor man's lineage. So here we are going into the trash 80 Model 1 to Leif Elzenstein, Sol 20, and then the Commodore PET. And the world of the explosion of Apple, there's some really great artifacts there, like Jeff Raskin's joystick for the Apple II, the first joystick. Real early production Apple IIs that were assembled by Daniel Kottke. Great stuff there. Great documentation. Here's some good original OSI Challenger, Vector 1. The story of the Northstar Horizon and its drive controller, which have two cards with 24 chips on each, compared to Wozniak's drive controller with 8 chips controlling 2 floppies. You know, figure that one out. It's hard to figure out, but it's true. And then portable systems, there's a Osborne 1 signed by Lee, who later, we found the schematic for the Osborne 1, and he gave us a tour. It's a video tour of the schematic, and you should see it on the site. It's on Digibarn TV. And there's a Gazelle, Seattle Computer Products Gazelle, the machine that DOS was written for, before Microsoft. And that leads into the IBM world. There's the IBM 5120. The last personal computer IBM manufactured itself. People don't realize that. And then the IBM PC and AT, and then the clones, and Next, which is off in its own world. And Apple, the birth of the Macintosh. There's a whole bunch of pins there on a Macintosh beach towel. And here's the Black Macs and the suitcase Apple II that Daniel Kottke made to play music. It's the grandfather of the iPod. And Computer Lib and Altair Notes and Finite State Fantasies, it's all beautiful. This is all new computer books for the last couple of years. It's an explosion in computer history books. Some of them self-published, some of them published by imprints. And then we go upstairs. Remember how there's an upstairs part. This is the former Halos, and this is the Tunnel of T-shirts. You go through this hallowed Tunnel of T's. They don't, no they don't. Here's the world of Xerox. So on the right, we have the Dolphin, the D0, the first machine to run MESA. This is Larry. This is EM009, the first machine that ran a MESA instruction. And we've got Dave Boggs Ethernet drop to Dave Boggs Dorado here, from donated from Park. That means something to some of you. And then, of course, on the left, the great Xerox Alto and Xerox Star. And then we go into the next room, and it's the bedroom room full of the game systems, Pong, everything running. And the great exhibit of the beige invasion of the 80s. Everything had to be the same color as the IBM PC. Remember those days? And the operating system wars area. So this is the themes of what was really happening in those era, the Reagan era. And then we have all these running machines. This one lovingly restored by Ed Phelan and his son. And the Tempest Macintoshes made for battleship use and CIA use. These weird Macs, totally weird Macs. Various running machines, video toaster, that's a B-Box. Various machines. There's a Atari 400. And next slab, an Apple II, that's a Reader Rabbit on the Apple II. The Xerox 6085 running Viewpoint. And the Audrey running the DigiBurn website. And over there on the left is my environment, the Elixir desktop, which I wrote in the 80s. And down to the world of Macintosh. Here's the Apple's maybe only 6% of the market, but it's about 25% of the history of microcomputing. And it's got such a footprint on design. And so here's our various Macs, the beloved or deprived pizza box era of the Macintosh, which is now in the past. All next, sitting next to the Cray 1. Here's another view of the Cray 1. We've got the power distribution cabinet, one of only two in the world, we were told. But it's an open Cray, so you can go in and pull boards out and put your hands in all that 100 miles of wiring, and you can. Most New Age people come to the Boulder Creek area to stand in redwood rings and commune with spirits of nature. But nerds, they can come and stand in here, and they can absorb the thermonuclear yield calculations from Lawrence Livermore Labs. And there's the wonderful cabling. It's a real nice touch to it. There's our Cray Q2, which is extremely rare. It's the prototype for the Cray 2. And on the right is the weird thing. It's the S100 multiprocessor. It has 10 68,000 boards. And it's one of the largest S100s ever made. And it's this tower. It's this El Cheapo hobbyist supercomputer. So it sits next to the Cray. It cost about $50,000 to make, and the Cray was about $10 million in 1980. And Galen's Chachka wall. This is from kid pics to Timothy Leary's mind mirror. It's all there. And people have added to this over. Silicon Valley Guy Handbook is also very useful. And the masses come. Open houses end to the opening. So here are the throngs coming. And of course, you're trying to sleep in on a Saturday morning, and then you hear these cars pull up, and you say, oh, I forgot there's an open house today. And all these people show up, and you're in your 90s. But usually we're more prepared than that. But here's the parking. Here's the shuttle stop for when we had the big opening. We had about 350 people. We had to run shuttles from the next farm, the next horse ranch, and they could ride a shuttle back and forth. And the horse wranglers could not figure out what this thing was about. They just could not figure it out. Here's Galen and a guest. And here are the people crowding in, looking at the comptometers, which are very operable. They make nice ding sounds, like the Link, actually, some of them. Here's Alan projecting. And Alan, you made a great video at the beginning.
Yeah, are we ready for that?
Alan's a brilliant genius at mixing all these cheesy cultural themes into more serious things. So we have the Bee Gees.
Yeah, but I combine the music of the 70s with Michael. That's a real gem.
Tricky Dicky, and you realize how embarrassing the 70s were, even today. So here we are in the 70s, 1976. It's the Pong from Sears, the four-game Pong. Some kids are playing. And here's Brooke Burring telling us about the comptometers. And here's a great crowd in the open house. Crowds and crowds of nerds. And now we have, should work.
I was 6 years old, and I got a 400 with a peanut butter keyboard.
Oh my God.
That's what we used to call it.
I'll try running it straight.
Okay, well, one of the things about the Digibarn is that it's the artifacts are great. We love the hardware, but what's amazing are the stories that people have to tell about how they first got into computing and how it affected their lives and how much it meant to them on a personal level.
This projector cannot show video.
One of the things we do is collect these stories from people. We've got hundreds of stories now that are just profound in terms of how people have been changed by these machines, these Promethean devices. And this is one of them. Hopefully we'll be able to...
You know, I think this projector cannot show video.
Really? Well, it's mostly audio anyway.
Well, let's try.
Even though I spent all night making this.
Let's attempt to actually go down to 800 by 600. It's probably like, it might give us the ability to run this.
This was a very touching story. It was a kid from Sacramento. Well, kid. He was 8 years old when the Atari 400 came out, which changed his life.
Yeah. It's not gonna.
I was 6 years old, and I got a 400 with a peanut butter keyboard.
Oh my God!
That's what we used to call it.
Oh, 400!
Trying to type on that thing.
Classic.
You couldn't speed type on these things at all.
Oh no!
And all I ever did, I spent more time in BASIC than anything. There was a time I remember you get 7 graphics.
How long did you spend on these machines,
sir? Oh my God! 7-8 hours a day as a 6 year old. Later, I ended up getting an 800 XL. And I remember the keys are held in by this front panel. So when you take it off, you have to do it upside down. And if you lift it, I remember because I was curious and I was stupid and I was like 9. And my mom called for something and I had it sitting on my bed. And I came back mad and jumped on my bed with the keyboard wide open and the springs went everywhere. I didn't have an 800 XL anymore. This is like home for me right here. If it weren't for my uncle, I wouldn't be in the field I'm in now. We got the 400. I was 4, 5, maybe 6. And all he kept saying was, he was so supportive. I remember the book. I had that thing for 15 years and I never, ever lost it. I used it. It was like my Bible for the longest time. It was just basic, though. It was so simple. I'm having a geek buzz. My head is going nuts. My uncle owned an Atari shop.
Oh, handy.
I got all the free games. He gave me free systems and free toys. I remember the tape. There's a weird one for you. Just a memory that I'll never lose. We had the cassette drive for this. And I wanted to save my programs. And I was on the phone with him. And he said, type C save and the name of your program. And it'll save it to the cassette. So I'm typing S-E-A-S-A-V-E and S-E-E-S-A-V-E. I never thought, letter C, S-A-V-E, meant cassette. I was 7 or 8, I was young, but it took me hours to, that was my first computers are frustrating moment, you know, because over the years, there's millions of those, but that one was my first. I'll never forget it.
So next we go on to continue. Is it even worse now? Oh no, it's okay. This is at the Boulder Creek Brewery after the tours. Everybody goes out for a pint and meet with the Cray One. Now these are people love to have their pictures taken in the Cray One. This is our friend Amara. Here's a gang. Another gang. Another gang, a gal, another gal who you recognize. Wonderful. Kids kind of love it, although they're kind of not sure. You know, since they don't know about Star Trek, they don't get the beam up thing, which you'll see in the nearest WAS. So, speaking of celebrities, the celebrities came and they kept coming. This is Gordon Bell, who you'll see around here tomorrow. This is John Toole, Executive Director of this museum, and Len Shustek, who's the Chairman of the Board. And you guys know who these guys are? They're not like Digerati type people. Actually, the guy on the right is Brewster Kahle, the Internet Archive, and the guy on the left is Neil Stevenson, who wrote Snowcraft and the Baroque Cycle and many other things. And this is Ted Nelson of Hypertext fame. And he walked into the room with the Xerox Altos and everything like that and had this freak out moment and said, Xerox is where it all went wrong. And as Alan was saying, on his houseboat, he had an Apple, a Mac II, and what are you saying about Ted?
Well, I used to use his Avid computer. He had a floating houseboat with a floating computer, so you edit and it'd be floating at high tide. Funny thing about Ted is that even though he had a vision of the net before it actually happened and interactive links and all kinds of innovations, he had these systems in his mind and how computers should work. And when it actually came to using a computer, he didn't want anything to do with it. He thought it was really stupid, the interface, and he just could not really get into using a computer as they are. And so it's an interesting thing for a visionary to be that way. He's living in his own world.
Yeah, he's living like in an alternate universe where computing did not happen the way he dreamed it to be possible, yeah. And he's fighting it all the way.
So it's an interesting thing.
This is a fellow that I didn't know was actually as famous as he is now. This is Charles Simonyi, who came down for our Alto birthday party in 2003. And then he went to space and got hooked up with Martha Stewart. You've probably seen him. He's the inventor of Bravo, which was a word processor on the...
No, he isn't. He's the implementer of Bravo.
Butler invented Bravo. He's the coder in Hungarian. He wrote it in Hungarian, right? If you write programs for Microsoft Windows, the so-called Hungarian notation came from this guy.
Well, he is Hungarian.
And he is Hungarian. It's a language that can never be decrypted. And of course, here's Woz. Funny, we gave him this is Apple II number 400 or something, and he grabs it, puts it up to his cheek, and says, "Darling, where have you been? It's been too long." And there he is describing how he designed he actually sort of was whispering this, that he designed the interface or something to do with the Twiggy drive. And he didn't want to be known for that. Anyway, and of course the artifacts, why do you have artifacts? So that people can tell the stories, because in 25 or 50 years or whatever, everybody associated with the artifacts will be gone. And they will be silent, and artifacts aren't really a whole lot of value unless you have the people's stories around them. So I got interested because of the telling of the Xerox story. And we took this bushy tree diagram from the IEEE about 3 years ago and started extending it. And it talks about visual computing systems from the concept from MEMEX and going through all these systems. And a student of computing history and myself sort of just tried to extend that to show how visual computing systems came about.
Is the link on there?
The link is not on there, no.
Yeah.
No. And it will be. And this is actually part of my story. I wrote this, this is on a t-shirt, I wrote this graphical operating system in the 80s for Xerox that was a derivative of the Star but written completely from scratch. I had to do all the pull-down menus, all the windowing system, everything. And it ran on a DOS machine on a high-res screen. It was called the Elixir. And generated all the bills you received in the mail since. And statements.
Thanks.
So that's the Elixir system. And this is why I got interested in Xerox, because we were basically taking some of Xerox PARC and Xerox's innovations and getting them out on the standard platform called the PC. And this is before Windows. The Mac had just come out. And we sort of looked at the Mac interface. And we'd worked on Xerox Stars and stuff. Like, the Mac was like a toy environment to people who worked on the Star environment. And so this is actually a remnant of the Star, Xerox Star, in the IBM PC world. Still running at many sites. It's about 3,000 sites it's at. Daniel Kottke gave us one of the first stories. This is him holding up WireWrap number 5 of the Macintosh. And this particular board has got the little original Macintosh band logo on it called Mr. Macintosh. It's actually a guy in a trench coat wearing like in a Macintosh with boots. And that was the original that was a logo, and it disappeared in the production. That's his famous suitcase computer to play music, the great-grandfather of the iPod. He basically grabbed a flat panel CRT out of the junk pile when Jeff Raskin had ordered these in late 79 to start the Macintosh project, and Daniel grabbed one of them, stuck it in this, basically it's a litigator's briefcase, shoved an Apple II board in, and put the keyboard in, and a music keyboard on the side, and wired it in, and he could play the notes on the keyboard, record them with BASIC, change the pitch and everything, and put them on floppies, and then carry this thing around and play it in bars, bass music. And we discovered this in Daniel's usual pile of stuff in his basement on Webster Street in Palo Alto, and he described the story, and I said, this is amazing, and this is kind of like the first portable musical computer based on a microprocessor, but he just invented this on his own in 1980.
It was a synthesizer as well.
Yeah, you could compose music too. So people come over and they pull their iPods out and they say, Grandpa, tell me a story. And, you know, we kept getting documents like, oh, Homebrew Computer Club newsletter number two. And who are all these people? So that led to the Homebrew event of 2005. And then this weird one came in. This was, this is weird. I mean, take a look at this. Okay, do your digital archaeology on this one. So you've got an Apple computer cassette. It's probably, this is AppleSoft Basic, but the AppleSoft Basic is stamped on top of a sticker that says Albuquerque, New Mexico, Microsoft. So we called Paul Allen's people, and they called us back, and they said, oh, this was probably made by Paul in Albuquerque at MITS, or just post-MITS, and sent to Apple. And Apple must have sent them the stickers, and then Microsoft put their thing on it, and Apple got it back and put their thing on it, and that was the BASIC for the Apple II, before it was in ROM. So this is a real neat piece of history. This is like the missing link between the two companies. And this was in the era when, as one of the people told me, he said, oh yeah, this was the era where if you called Microsoft, Bill Gates picked up the phone. If you called Apple, Steve Jobs picked up the phone. You know, that was just the way it was. So this actually became the basis for our involvement in the microcomputer gallery project in New Mexico that just opened the wing on the museum that Paul Allen built. And I think that this is printed out somewhere, and it's up in printout, because it shows how Albuquerque was connected in with the microcomputer. But it's an interesting, when you get something like that, it's like, it's not just the cassette, you know, there's something, a story it tells. This was a profound story. This is so profound and such dangerous information that we dare not put the whole thing on the website. But the story behind this is, the thing on the left, the big blue thing on the left says, Preliminary Macintosh Business Plan, 12th of July, 1981. Now, this is a profound document. Daniel and I were looking through the usual boxes of crap in his house. He's got the entire Haight Ashbury in there, too, somewhere. And we were pulling stuff out of this box, and his eyes went wide, and it was like, oh my God, there it is. This blue, about 25 sheets of paper. And it's the original Macintosh business plan. And so we started looking through it, and it was really interesting because it was Apple's 20-year plan for its future to build the Macintosh and the Lisa. What were they going to do in the market? Who were the competitors? And we looked at this competitors page, and it was like, wait a minute, IBM's not on here. What's going on here? It's like a month before the IBM PC was launched, literally a month, 30 days. So they didn't even know IBM. Oh, IBM, they're not in personal computers. We don't have to worry about them. We have to worry about K-Pro. You know, our Texas Instruments. And then all through the document are pull-down menus on the top of each page. It's like there's a pull-down menu that says this page is about competitors, and then there's an icon. And you see an icon there that has a Xerox little thing. It's like a Xerox machine with a stroke through it. And we were like, and Daniel's saying, wait a minute, I've got the whole history back in my head now. This was written by Johanna Hoffman, who we met subsequently about 8 months later at an Apple event. But it was written at Xerox PARC. We're saying, wait a minute, how can this be possible? Well, Johanna wrote this business plan, and this was when Steve had come into the project and pushed Jeff Raskin out of the project. 1981, and said, we got to have a business plan for this, you know, crazy bunch of enterprises. And so Johanna was tasked to take all the notes and write up. She wrote it beautifully on an Apple III, printing it on an image writer. Steve would get it and said, this looks like crap, you know. And she's going, oh, geez. I either have to go to a layout shop, you know, and do it in the letter set or whatever, you know. Where can I go? And I know Steve's going to want change after change after change. Where can I go where I'll find a computer that can do documents on the screen, graphics, printed on a laser printer, on a all points addressable printer? I know. I have a friend at Xerox PARC. I'll go there in the middle of the night. So after security had gone home or whatever, she'd go to this office at Xerox PARC at Cuyahoga Hill Road, pull this platter off the top shelf, carefully hidden behind a bunch of stuff, put it into the Alto, boot it up, and write the business plan for Apple for the next 20 years. Now, if this isn't the biggest case of industrial espionage in the world, and for those out there who say, there's no connection between PARC and Apple and the Mac product, there's no connection at all. You know, they're wrong. So what she would do is go into the paint program, it's a Doodle, I think it was, and do the icon work. She did the, she bit-clicked. She like, okay, I'll, basically she's running a machine that is the vision for what Apple's going to build, to build a business plan to compete with the company that invented the stuff. And it gets kind of more complicated than that. So she then bit-clicked this icon there. This is all done in Bravo X on the Alto. And she was like, when I talked to her about it, I said, there's like many more meanings to this little icon you made, isn't there?
Yeah.
Oh, we're not copying Xerox. Or we're going to kill Xerox. We're going to productize this and kill it. Or we didn't steal it from Xerox. You know, or do not copy document. But there's a huge, between that and that is a huge amount of iconic symbolism, I would say. So we dutifully said, this is like a huge explosive document. And Daniel said, what are we going to do with it? And I said, well, I'll scan it in. It's all scanned in. And Daniel said, don't put it on the DigiBarn site. If it's on the DigiBarn site and Steve sees it, he'll blow his freaking top. If he sees this thing, he'll remember it, he'll blow his top. Especially the story about PARC. Because there were all kinds of lawsuits in the 80s that went nowhere for Xerox. Xerox vainly trying to recapture some of the intellectual property it invented and couldn't do it. And the judges said, you didn't do a good enough job. If this had emerged, then Xerox would have won those lawsuits, probably. Anyway, so we put the cover page on the site, just the cover, and said, serious scholars need to come see this in person. You can't copy this. And we kept getting little bit messages here and there. And then 3 months later, we had a call from senior legal counsel at Apple. So it was on the DigiBarn machine. I didn't want to write back. I didn't want to phone them back. I was like, this is the end. You know, there's going to be helicopters, black helicopters coming down with Apple logos, and guys with glasses and black turtlenecks will be coming out. You know, it'd be like Men in Black or something. And I called them back, and I said, how much trouble are we in? And the senior legal counsel was saying, you're not in any trouble. What are you talking about? Oh, forget I said that. You know, what's going on? And he said, Steve has ordered on campus all stuff with rainbow logos on it, the rainbow Apple logo, to be discarded. Just get rid of it all. I don't want any old stuff around here. Do you want it? And I said, oh, sure. And so this truck pulled up with crates of documents and a perfect Apple III and stuff from the legal department, all this stuff, including, you know, Woz's design for the Twiggy drive and all that stuff. And they said, we as lawyers cannot put this in the crusher. We cannot destroy this material. It's just against our very nature. So we interpreted crush, destroy, shred as being it goes off campus and never returns. And so I said, you're going to be putting this under the Creative Commons license. You realize this? We don't care. It is salvage. It is yours. Do it with it what you want. You know, it's Apple's corporate memory and legacy, part of it, a little piece of it. So that's what's happened. So that's what happened out of this story. And the last little document, which was pretty profound, and I don't know Rich Today, the artist who drew this and wrote this. If anybody does, let me know. He wrote a couple of other books. But this is a really great comic from the summer of 1976 called Finite State Fantasy. And it's all about the burgeoning microcomputer homebrew community. And this is about a kid, Arnold, who gets his homebrew kit in the mail and he's soldering it together. And he finally finishes it. Now he's dragging his user interface over. And he's possessed, right? You can see that I'm going to code possessed stare. You've all had it, right? Code is filling your brain. And he goes over and the professor says, as if possessed, Arnold drove himself, staying at the keyboard day and night, not stopping to eat or sleep. You know, we've all been there. Some of us are still there. And at last, his alternate reality was completed. Now, this is a vision in this comic book for what are microcomputers going to be used for. And here he is. He's going into his alternate reality. I don't know why he has to strip naked, but... and he, of course, meets this ideal girl. Now, which do you choose to believe? Did he go into some kind of virtual reality, or did he just simply die, you know, on the floor? And so this is an incredible artifact because it's like, it was one guy's crazy vision for what are personal computers going to be used for? To escape reality and go into these three-dimensional worlds and be with people and have affairs. Does it sound familiar? Does it sound familiar? And so the great message of this cartoon book was, it's just another tool. Use it. Don't let it use you. Did we listen? And this led, all these discovery of these stories led to the people behind the stories to our annual 30-plus years birthday events. We figured that if 30 years have gone by for anything, most people can't remember it, and the original people barely can, and it's interesting if it's 30 years ago. So we started out with 2003, you know, Xerox wasn't doing anything to mark the 30th birthday of the Alto, so we did a party. There's the Alto there. And there's the panelists, and the Alto sitting there as part of the panel. And there's where we started the birthday cake tradition, and you'll see another birthday cake tomorrow if Lucky's hasn't screwed it up. And there's Charles Simone cutting the cake. And then 2004, we said, okay, what's another piece of obscure but important history that needs to be recovered? And for me, it was somebody had handed me this sheet of paper with this eyeball on it and this maze. And I said, what is that? And he said, it's Maze War. It's a multiplayer shooter game that we played on the Xerox Star, we played on the Alto, and it was played on the IMLAC PDS-1 at NASA Ames. It was played at Project Mac at MIT. It was played all over the ARPANET. I said, this is phenomenal. This is the first first-person shooter. It's actually the first multi-user 3D game on the internet. And there was like legendary mentions of this that in Congress or somebody proposed putting computers into Congress or something, and someone had written, the members will all be playing Maze War. And so it's really interesting because the mid-70s we had very serious uses of the ARPANET, and this was the heart-pounding game. So you have the same modality as you have today, the same dichotomy. And so I was intent on recovering this history, and we found this guy. He had a working IMLAC PDS-1. We found the source code for it. I think it was at MIT, and he put it in, and it worked, and then we built a connection with a modern computer network. We rebuilt Maze War so they could all be playing in the same maze as the IMLAC. The IMLAC was from 72. There's the birthday cake. And then 2005, you know, how could you not celebrate the Homebrew Computer Club? So here's our Homebrew Computer Club panel. And we were playing, is Steve Dompier here? We were playing Steve's Fool on the Hill and Daisy? Oh, there's Crunch. Okay. Homebrew club members, wave your hands. Homebrew club. Okay. So we had, we literally had flicked, you know, I didn't do it, put in your code and had the cheap AM radio and you could hear the music distinctly. So that was a great thing that was done at the Homebrew reunion. Here's our Homebrew membership. And Len, you were on the phone, I think, from this. And here's, that's Bob Lash gesturing at a younger version of himself. And there's Lee Felsenstein seeing a younger version of himself gesturing with a threatening stick at the Homebrew Computer Club meetings at Stanford. And that, on the left, that was a great artifact sent to me. It's a t-shirt from Personal Computing 76, which was kind of the first personal computing trade fair. And that shirt was given to me by the man who gave the table to Jobs, Wozniak, and Kotke to show the Apple I. So I wore So Kotke signed it later, and Woz signed it later, and I've got to find Steve Jobs to sign it. I don't know if you ever will. But it's a great historic t-shirt. And there's the last year we did the Apple 30th birthday party. Apple had a little mention of it at Macworld. Steve Jobs had a mention of it, but they didn't have a party, so we did the party. And there's Woz cutting the cake, and there were two Apple I's on either side of the panel. It was great. Liza Loop's Apple I and Jeff Raskin's wife's Apple I. Jeff's Apple I's on the other side. And this year, tomorrow at 1 o'clock, in hopefully not this area because this is kind of a yucky area, so I'm going to move us in there, you'll see the link. And the link is also running in the exhibit hall when it opens. And the link, to my mind, is the beginnings of personal computer. It's really the first sort of personal workstation devoted to one person that you turn off at night, you program it, you load your own software, you can transport it. So it's a phenomenally important artifact in the history of computing, and you'll see it all restored as our fifth birthday party in the next room. And please go up and talk to them. The link people can wave their hands. This is the link team. The link recovery team is all here. So there'll be a nice cake as well. So audiences responded very positively to the events. Some views of the audience. And, of course, there's audience, too. Same audience member. And last but not least, what happens, there's this incredible cycle that occurs with this kind of a project that takes over one's life. The web traffic begot the media attention, which begot the donations, which beget the stories, which beget this cycle of hundreds of pending web updates that have yet to be done. Right now, as of last night, DigiBurn has 193,000 references on Google. And this led to this flood of media coverage in the various bits and pieces. And so our first media coverage was BBC Radio. This is Peter Day, who has this, this is his interviewer's face. He described this as being that he has a face that can convince anyone that he's completely enthralled with what they're saying. And he said, believe me, this is from training.
Well, here we get him to go to Burning Man from this.
We got him to go to Burning Man, and he was completely enthralled with Burning Man. But he's wearing his old, he's wearing his school tie at Burning Man, but nothing down below. So this is Discovery Channel interviewing Alan and I inside our bus, which is also at the barn at the farm. They didn't use any of these segments, but it was a fun interview. This is, as a kid, I loved Star Trek, and we'll show you the Star Trek episode in a bit. I loved Star Trek so much, and I always, as a kid, wanted to be beamed in and out of something. And when the Discovery Channel called us, 1 minute. Oh, okay. Let's go to the Discovery event. Here's more. What?
For YouTube.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we started late because there's no connector or anything here. Can we do the link event in the next room tomorrow? Oh, okay. Okay. So I'll just whip through these. This is CNET television. Wozniak being interviewed, looking at his original invitation to the US Festival. This is Alan on French TV. Alan and I on another documentary. That's our computers on screensavers. That's Leo Laporte. Leo Laporte, CBS News in New York. I was on that program. CBS News. Woz came back. Discovery Channel show. Pigs being interviewed. Newspaper stories. And we'll go on to this. Well, it'll run on this screen. Okay, here we go.
In the 50s and 60s, I seem to remember, computers were the size of this rock. Then they became the size of this rock. They were used for boring things like planning nuclear strikes. And then they became used for interesting things like games and emails. You ask me, how did that happen? Because... Now, there were two things that caused the computer revolution. One was the invention of the microchip. Ta-da! The old computers had been so huge, because all their insides were full of thousands of sort of cables and valves and stuff. Once the microchip arrived, all these valves and thingamajigs could be shrunk to the size of a peanut. Computers could now shrink, too. But what could we do with smaller computers? Well, that's where Star Trek came in. Small, easy-to-use computers were everywhere in the Enterprise. You see where I'm going with this? This is the town of Boulder Creek that lies above the mountains of the high-tech world of Silicon Valley in Northern California. Now, it may look like an average town, but Boulder Creek has one of the most remarkable museums in the world. To find out more, we need to speak to this man, Bruce Stammer. Now, Bruce is just an average country boy. He likes nothing more than tending his livestock, hanging out in the homestead, and dressing like Shakespeare. Now, he may have an interesting dress sense, but Bruce is one of the world's foremost experts in the history of computing. And it's not more pigs he keeps in that barn. Bruce has spent more than 10 years building a collection of computers that span the entire history of the machine's development, from $20 million supercomputers through the rapid development of the personal computers we take for granted today, reflecting the progress of the biggest beasts in today's industry and some of the ideas that became extinct. His collection got so big that Bruce has turned his shed into a museum called the DigiBar. So where did Bruce's love of computers come from? I'll give you one guess. That's right. Back in the 60s, Star Trek was telling the world that one day, computers would be multi-purpose, everyday tools.
Computed and recorded, dear.
With which we might all constantly interact.
Computer, you will not address me in that manner.
The sexy, technological innovation of the USS Enterprise had seduced the young Bruce Stammer and a generation of computer nerds.
When I was a kid, my brother and I used to lie in our bed and watch Star Trek. One of the things we always noticed, and that I always noticed, was Spock, whenever there was something to really be understood, he would go on the bridge over to a console that had like a hooded screen and look in, and blue light would shine on his face.
Oxygen, nitrogen, atmosphere suitable for human life support.
And I always wondered, what is this guy seeing on this screen?
While Spock was staring into his mysterious database portal, the rest of the crew could be seen using user-friendly computers in every aspect of their lives. A revolutionary idea that would change everything.
So all the geeks in the 60s are growing up, saw that and said, we got to make that real in the 70s. And they did.
But it wouldn't happen overnight. Star Trek may have shown early computer pioneers what the future might be, but it didn't tell them how to get there. This would take some experimentation. The first attempt came in 1974 with a whopping great blue box that is widely seen as the first ever personal computer. But it's not quite the PC we take for granted today. It came as a highly intricate build-it-yourself kit, and once you had finished soldering its circuit boards together, users would find that it didn't actually really do anything because software hadn't been invented yet. Yes, it wasn't perfect. But for thousands of would-be tech types, it was a start. And thanks to its Trek fan inventor, Ed Roberts, it had a somewhat familiar-sounding name.
So here we have the Sputnik for the nerd generation. This is the Altair 8800, named after a solar system in Star Trek.
Get directly for Altair 6. Altair 6.
I think I'm going to get spacesick.
This became the focus of many homebrew and personal computer clubs. Kids trying to figure out how to make this thing useful. And a couple of those kids were Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, and their version of the Altair useful was the Apple computer. And Bill Gates and his guys wrote BASIC, the language for this thing, and they created a company called Microsoft. So the modern world came out of this unassuming blue box.
And the rest is Star Trek.
And that, the last, we want to introduce you to the mascots of the DigiBarn, the pigs. And there's Theodore and the Wallow and Piglet saying, hey, get out of there. Your time is over. Off he goes. So, oink, thank you.